Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
This is taking the type of effort that makes it not fun to do or listen to.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you try to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 238, a talk with MC Paul Barman. MC Paul Barman first started making songs in the late 1990s during his time at Brown University. His wild songs about topics like a slacker college student who becomes half-man, half-goat in order to become a star quickly caught the ear of legendary producer Prince Paul, who produced Barman's 2000 EP, It's Very Stimulating. That project introduced Paul Barman to the hip-hop masses as a guy as likely to drop a reference to a Polish filmmaker as LL Cool J, and to write lyrics that incorporate elaborate rhyme schemes, acrostics, and even Morse code. Since It's Very Stimulating, Barman has released two full-length albums and several mixtapes. His brand new album, Echo Chamber, is out this Friday, May 18th, on Mellow Music Group. I sat down with him at the offices of Audible Treats in Gowanus, Brooklyn. If you like The Cipher, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecipher show. Every new patron helps Josh get a little closer to finishing the screenplay for his Weird Al biopic. Also, we know some of you want shirts and other stuff, so please go to merch.thecipherShow.com and get yourself a t-shirt. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecipherShow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. And now, here's the only man ever to rap in Morse code, MC Paul Barman. Sometime around It's Very Stimulating, you played Tufts, like a tiny house on campus. I think they called it the Arts House.
I remember that, sort of.
And I was working at Tufts at the time and was friends with a couple of the activist-y people on campus, including some who lived there.
What kind of activism were you involved in?
At that time, actually, I was still doing Food Not Bombs.
Uh-huh.
And just general kind of lefty
That's
stuff.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I think I actually knew one of them through Food Not Bombs people.
Did you silkscreen shirts and stuff at their silkscreen shop?
No, I did not. But yeah, so you played there. And I think that was the first time I met you. And I remember talking to you specifically about, it's crazy that you name drop Krzysztof Kieslowski on a song.
Uh-huh.
Because I love the Tricolors trilogy.
Me too.
So much.
So much.
My pissed off Jombrowski turned three colors like Krzysztof Kieslowski. It said a hand job's a man's job. Yo job's a blow job.
Krzysztof Kieslowski was an influential Polish director and screenwriter whose Three Colors trilogy, Blue, White, and Red, was released in 1993 and 1994.
And so that was my first encounter with seeing you perform.
Cool.
So I guess you vaguely remember that show fairly enough. It was a long time ago.
I'm trying to remember the exact house because I remember a Wesleyan house party and that's the wrong memory. What did it look like?
I mean, it was a long time ago. It was not exactly a dorm sort of on campus spot where a bunch of kids lived. And then actually after that, must have been right after that, I saw you at the Middle East Up.
Oh, was that with Dell and Tion?
I don't remember who was opening, but what I do remember—
I'm sure I was opening.
Yeah, I do remember that you were wearing a Volume 2 era J shirt and a lot of people in the audience. I don't remember if this is a Tufts or the Middle East.
What is that?
Like a Hard Knock Life era Jay-Z shirt.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure about that. To judge from your reaction, I don't know if you were serious, but you were very adamant that you were not wearing it ironically. That in fact, like—
I really like that album a
lot.
You
like that album and that people who were dismissive of you for wearing the shirt or thought you were wearing it ironically because that was some mainstream rapper and you were underground guy were completely—
It was Hard Knock Life Volume 2?
Volume 2, yeah.
I'm trying to remember which one is, whoever thought the young Sean Carter—
Volume 3.
Whoever thought young Sean Carter would change the game? Used to rap to the raindrops off my window pane.
That's my favorite.
You quote that line.
Oh, yeah.
Whoever thought Paul Barman would change the game? I started rhyming when the radio was unbearably lame. Rappers are in danger. Depression is closely followed by delusions of grandeur.
I'm glad you brought this up. So many compartments everybody is forced into.
Right.
Lyrics. I'm into lyrics.
What struck me about it was in a live performance situation, right? You want the audience on your side. And here you are kind of right off the bat being not exactly antagonistic, but challenging the audience, which I thought was really interesting.
Perhaps I naively think people will immediately be on my side after they've heard my brilliant lyrics.
I think it ultimately worked from what I remember about the performance. It was really good. But I wanted to jump forward for 1 second.
To the new album. What'd you think?
I love the new album, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
You did a rhymeslation, as you call it, of The Breaks, the TV show.
Oh my God. You said that.
The Breaks. Hey, do stay true. Go from hey you to breakthrough. The Breaks. Let's mix break beats for a big break debut and break down this Breaks crew. Nikki rips her scholarship to smaller strips. Holler's quick at 4A barfed on collar drip. David wants to be a program director. He needs to get through the slow jam selector.
Not only did I see that, I'll do you one better. I sent it to the show's co-creator.
You did?
I did. He loved it.
Dan Charnas?
Dan Charnas.
Nice.
Yeah.
My man Rob asked me to do that.
That kind of leads into rhymeslation more generally. So you take, for people who might not know, you take texts or events or something, the Art of War or an interview with RZA or whatever, and make them rhyme.
Strike at their gaps, attack when they're lax. Never let the enemy figure out how to act. 1 pound of food at the front takes 20 to carry it. In a chariot battle, reward the first to capture 10 chariots. Harriet?
So for a while, that was my thing. I thought it was really important for ideas that weren't mine. I was kind of like, who says my ideas are so important? Or who says I even have enough of them? And there's all this world of ideas to pull from. And, you know, I was kind of obsessed with it for a while, especially during the W years when facts were endangered and fraught.
Good thing we got past that.
I know. I thought that time was over completely. So it just seemed like revolutionary to, you know, state things plainly as they are and make them presented in a way that could be forever remembered. Mm-hmm. So I was just kind of applying my skill and interests to the world around me after kind of having an ego crisis of being on stage or being a persona or what have you. Mm. And that style has manifested not just from me, you know. Ironically, Weird Al has like a rich history of doing that. Like he has a song about the pancreas.
Secreting those enzymes. Secreting those hormones too. Metabolizing carbohydrates just for me.
Things of that nature. Mm-hmm. It blew my mind when Nas did an autobiography of Rakim.
Mm-hmm.
January 28, 1968. Born into this world, William Griffin the Great, chapter one.
Which is why I ended up
Weird Al.
Yeah, so, I was like, oh my God, what if it was like a sort of a satire of a song about my favorite MC ever by one of my favorite MCs? And it was about a satirist, but everything in it was true.
October 23rd, 1959, born the best-selling recording humorist of all times to first-generation Americans who'd already got the hang of it. Alfred Matthew Yankovic, Linwood High School.
And, you know, that kind of like onion peel thing mm-hmm. turns me on.
And, yeah. And it's not a mean-spirited song either to Weird Al or to the original UBR song.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Why would I do anything but pay my respects?
Yeah.
So I kind of got way past that style, but then Art of War is something that is kind of one of my favorite rhymes of all times. And I'm so glad you're asking me about it. I just shot the video for it last week.
Nice.
Let me show you what I did.
For people who can't see it, this is a tiny little handmade book with the song's lyrics that it looks like you kind of folded origami style.
So that's the magic trick at the end. I don't know if we want to give that away before the video comes out, but I'm turning digital art into as close as telepathy as humanly possible. Because see, I figured out how to make it one-sided piece of paper. And at the end of the video, there's going to be a download PDF.
For you to make one.
There's instructions in the internal workings.
Wow.
That'll get absorbed into it. And there'll be a companion video showing you how to do it too.
Wow. Nice. And so this goes back to, I'm assuming, your childhood love of origami.
Yes.
So
and books.
Pop-up books, right? You did a piece talking to some great pop-up book makers.
Man, you really seen my stuff. Yeah, that was for Wired Magazine.
We'll have a link to Paul's article in the show notes.
Was that
Sabuda
personal
and
interest
Reinhardt.
And then you pitched it
yep.
to them?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So what about pop-up books made?
I guess just is similar to rhymes, having a form that can be pushed ever further.
Mm-hmm. Similar with origami, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So how good did you get at origami?
Extremely good. I got extremely good. I kind of fell off a bit. But the funny thing is, some of the really hard books that I folded when I was a kid have been republished with better instructions. And some of the guys who were making those books ended up working for NASA and creating foldable space telescope lenses and stuff that were lightweight and able to create all kind of prismatic angles after unfolded in space.
Wow.
Yeah. Amazing stuff.
You are obviously someone who thinks a lot about rhymes, talking about rhymeslation, translating an interview with RZA or whatever into rhyme, so forth. One thing that, since I have you here, wanted to ask about with in terms of rhyme is how you think about it, right? You take two ideas, concepts, people's names, whatever it is, that are seemingly unrelated,
mm-hmm.
and you rhyme them, something happens, some kind of connection is made.
So in the early days, like the Krzysztof Koslowski stuff, I just thought it would be refreshing to hear names sourced from different areas of culture than were typically used.
Mm-hmm.
I've since totally abandoned that. I don't know if you noticed on the new album, there's practically no proper nouns whatsoever.
Right.
And which few ones are there, if it's obscure, there's a purpose to it. Somewhere in the middle, you know, Wu-Tang was like a heavy educational resource for a lot of us, I think, mm-hmm. when they were saying things we never heard of, and then we would run to research them.
Right.
I've come to not want to do that so much. Partly it's from the performing I did in between, where I wanted a more immediate reaction. And partly it just seemed like if the rhymes are coming first, then the ideas are not coming first.
Mm.
And the ideas are much more important. So I think it's pretty natural to start with details and stuff. It's kind of like learning to draw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over time, you end up having song concepts that are much more important. And if a name that you wouldn't expect rhymed with something else fits in, fine. That being said, not knowing which rhyme comes next is practically the religion of any lyricist worth his sea salt.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Not knowing, you're saying, what is going to rhyme with the word you just heard.
Never knowing what comes next is what makes me addicted to lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
It's so incredibly compelling that way. Once it's predictable,
then it's a nursery rhyme, right? Then it's Dr. Seuss.
Well, I wouldn't disparage Dr. Seuss, but it's not that thing that sucks in your whole attention.
Mm-hmm. So I have a friend who's done a bunch of musical theater composing.
Oh, cool.
And then moved into pop lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had to think a lot about very strict rhymes that, you know, is basically all that the musical theater form allows, and then moving into kind of the more slantish rhymes or approximations uh-huh. allowed by pop lyrics. Where do you fit on that spectrum? And has that what you allow yourself to do changed over the years?
Well, you know, you can definitely take it as a challenge to come up with a fresh monosyllabic rhyme. And those things can be a greater challenge and they can hit harder, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I'm capable of putting myself on being outside myself enough to like put myself in a spectrum, mm-hmm. so to speak. What do you think?
I don't know. I think I remember reading you saying something about how you had kind of loosened up a little bit over the course of time.
Definitely.
Very, very strict. Like things had to rhyme exactly.
Oh. It has to be pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a good reason for it to be off. I see what you're saying now.
Yeah. It can't be just, it has a same vowel sound, like an M&M or something.
It depends. You know, language is ours to sculpt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you don't necessarily see yourself as being on any particular part of that spectrum. It's just sort of what?
Every time you ask me if I'm on the spectrum, I think we're talking about something else.
Right. We are not talking about autism. Fair enough.
That being said, I'm dying to write songs for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done it here and there.
I was going to say, you talked about that a few years ago. You were like, you used King and Goffin as an example of what you would like to do down the line. Everybody's doing
a brand new dance now. In the early 1960s, Carole King and her then husband, Jerry Goffin, with her writing music and him writing lyrics, composed a string of huge pop hits, including Will You Love Me Tomorrow, Up on the Roof, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, The Locomotion, and many more.
When did I say that?
I
still believe that. Yes.
Have you done things that you would kind of consider songwriting for other people?
I had a small part in Be Kind Rewind, and I ended up writing some of the end credits song.
There's more to life than this old place has. Put your dreams in suitcase.
I collaborated a little bit with that composer named Jean-Michel Bernard. He had an album called Jazz for Dogs that I wrote a few songs on that I didn't sing.
Phone on the shoulder, back that's almost broken. Nurse and bra soaked in milk, both ovens open.
I'm kind of adapting A Tale Dark and Grim on Simmer right now. So for a minute there, I was kind of demoing pop tracks, but yeah.
Why didn't that work?
People would like put a song on reserve and blow a lot of smoke at it. And I was just like, let me take this love for songwriting and keep loving it and make money other ways.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. One of the things I noticed about your work, listening back to it, is like the way you handle characters.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yep.
What really cemented it for me was Exiled from the Get Along Gang, but there's obviously plenty of other examples.
Yes.
Right? Where you have these characters and there's something about them that's comically exaggerated, but they also have very relatable personalities and quirks.
Sure.
And they speak in rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
You let a girl see the girls I drew. Tore down the whole free world I knew. So walk on by if you see me at the candy store. I'll be stiff like a statue by Henry Moore. I'll see you in school, but never on weekends. I'm changing the handshake gesture sequence so you'll never get through the club entry door. You're not a Sunbeam warrior anymore.
And some of them are comic, just in terms of what they physically are, the kind of like made up animal or whatever. How do you kind of fit that all together?
What do you mean, how do I fit it all together?
Like, that's a lot to do to put into a character.
Well, that's the beauty of audio, right? Mm-hmm. You create the skeleton and the listener's imagination lays the skin. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. The idea of like making a character both actually have a recognizable personality, but then also kind of be exaggerated and comic was pretty interesting to me.
Thank you for noticing.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess in that case, you know, I wanted to challenge Mike and force him to respond in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Next message marked urgent. Well, ain't this a fine howdy-do? Although I must admit I am kind of proud of you. When you were mad in the past, you were lucky to let it pass and acted all passive-aggressive.
Normally, I don't want to be a cartoonish anything, but he's just such a superlative straight man.
Mm-hmm.
And his voice is so perfect. And I also wanted to, I don't know if this answers your question, but I wanted to overcome the disconnect of emailing verses by really instigating a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a way to make sure that would happen. I feel like I'm not answering your question.
No,
it's like a matter of motivation.
Yeah, absolutely. The book you made, the pop-up book there, reminded me that you had talked about using index cards to write your songs on. Is that still a method you use?
So the packaging for the album is insane. It's like a huge booklet of those index cards.
Reproductions of actual ones you used?
Yeah. Like half of them I used and half of them I had to create for the insert.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really easy way to not be on your phone. And it's a great way to edit on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great way to just kind of stay organized.
So the idea is you'll write two lines or four lines or something, however much will fit on an index card, and then write the next lyric on another card.
I'm afraid that talking about it makes it a big gimmick, but it has been a way that I've stayed super organized.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like the way that, what's the word I want? When something spontaneous happens, not synchronicity. Do you know the word I'm looking for?
Paul texted Sean shortly after the interview to say the word he was searching for here was serendipity.
Good luck, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, I'm just this was there? Like, basically, I'll forget I wrote something, so mm-hmm. I have to write it down. And index cards are, I always make sure, are available, kind of like a sketchbook as well. Mm. I should add that one reason I'm so excited about the new work is that it's not as constructed as the earlier albums. Like, some of it, like, comes out. Like, I don't remember writing it. Mm-hmm. Or it'll be a first thing in the morning thing. Or it'll be after some sort of meditative experience. And this stuff comes out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is on 99.9999%. A lot of that stuff is on antennas. And, you know, when people are asking me, why are you doing this? I think it's exciting to share the stuff that came through you. It's weird to hold back that stuff.
You know, it's funny. We just had Fonte on the show not too long ago.
I have to hear that episode.
And he was talking about how he wrote about half of his last album in a 1 week burst. And because it happened so quickly, he was sort of, you know, delirious and overtired for a lot of it. And it was very easy for him to get into a zone that he borrowed this term, he said, from Quincy Jones, a zone he called the alpha state, being able to create and not even fully conscious that you
know, it's funny you say that, because I've been going to these sound baths, and what they claim to do is put you in a theta state.
Oh.
So I wonder if they're talking about the same thing or if there's a difference. Mm. But absolutely, that's the exciting stuff. That's when you're channeling and the whole name that goes on top of it is a little bit irrelevant.
Right. You're someone who continually is trying to push the envelope. Your first album, there was an acrostic. Then there was a double acrostic.
Yes.
My close pals, aunts, uncles, leaders, nations and towns, hamlets and neighboring islands, everyone, landlords, bosses and relatives, moms and newborns.
On the joy of your world, Barman spits a line that, if you take the first letter of each word, spells out MC Paul Nathaniel Barman. On Back on a White Horse, Barman raps what he calls a double acrostic, where taking the first letter of each word in the line of the song spells out a different word. Mirror, clever, peace, anger, urban life, before, after, rapport, master, always, never. If you take the first letter of each of those words, it spells out MC Paul Barman.
My intellect reaps, rewinds on repeat.
Mirror.
More introspection, refine, remind, or retreat.
Mirror.
Crazy lyrics, every verse, every rhyme.
Clever.
Classic lines, emotions vanquish, English redesign.
Clever. MC.
And then there was probably, I think, on the same album, rapping in Morse code. You have, you know,
I call it Morse cadence.
Morse cadence.
My rhymes are people. They elect me to rap. Each part is simple select. Me with pep and care. And the Geron's gift trip. All respect to get the...
In a section of a song, Science, the short and long sounds in the lyrics, if equated to dots and dashes, respectively, spell out in Morse code the name of the album on which the song appears, Thought Balloon Mushroom Cloud. Jesus.
You left out the palindrome.
Strings of palindromes, right? You had with three or four palindromes together.
Uh-huh.
On your mock set, Gorgonzola. Ahava, ha, ha. I ram Mariah a lot, Tomatola. And that's three palindromes in a row, though.
So what's left?
Well, did you catch some of the double meanings on Undoing Aloneness?
I may have missed them. I'll have to go back.
Okay. Memory Man kept trying to educate me on battle rap. And every time I would watch the links he sent me, I felt pretty dirty afterwards.
How do you mean?
It's like, no matter how brilliant the lyrics may be, there can just be this undercurrent of nastiness where I'm not sure I did the right thing by watching it. But then I started understanding why he was like, no, you gotta understand what's going on here. These battlers, I presume anyone who was listening to this would already know this, but that's where unbelievable advancements in lyrics is happening. A lot of it is happening without music, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously human voice is music and all that. But what really twisted my wig was Daylight versus Mike P. He has a particular scheme about snakes.
He's talking about snakes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of like white man, reptile, this and that. Mm-hmm. And the way that he throws in these double meanings and manipulates language, I was like, damn, Daylight, you did it.
Another snake, man. Worry about his reptilian tail rattling. Another live reviper shot. What's the holdup? Anaconda nigga I am. I rap tight as hell. Serpent out of this world. Man, this shit is cold, bro.
This is the most advanced lyricism I have ever heard. I gotta advance on this if I possibly can. And that became what I ended up calling undoing aloneness. Mm-hmm. When I first tried the technique, I felt like a corny, like world pun championships contestant. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized how important the context is, where double meanings are mind-blowing if they're used in a pointed direction. So then I was like, well, I can see why they're so powerful in battles. So who do I want to battle, right? Mm-hmm. So then I thought, well, if you're battling yourself, that even adds another layer to why a double meaning should exist. And if the theme that you're incorporating is about splitting, which is certainly in keeping with the schizophrenia required of us in day-to-day life, then we really have something here. And then if I throw in all the Freudian defenses and all the wordplay, and I have a beat with a tempo that's plodding or slow enough for me to get every little syllabic inflection in so that it could be two things. So that's what was next for me on this album.
I never met a forward playmate I didn't trust. Feel ire each time I reach toward hidden lust. Whether in a minaret or a kill flourish or a must to keep your head up, that hostage ostrich bit the dust. I never metaphor, wordplay, mate I didn't trust. Feel ire each time I reach toward hidden lust. Even in a minna, rhetoric kill flourish, sure a must to keep your head up, that hostage ostrich bit the dust.
That being said, like, I don't think that these formal things are the important things. Mm-hmm. I think the ideas are always more important, but I also think that's what's so exciting about, the genre, I hate to say the genre, but is that, you know, we were always waiting for Kane to outdo his competition or himself, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So I would feel remiss if I didn't have a thing on a full length like that. Yeah. And that's what's on this one.
Okay. And Leapfrog. So what was going on with that? Talk about the structure of that. Cause you originally had this idea of you were going to pan the lines left and right.
Yeah. Well, so in Hot Guacamole, I'm going back and forth with Doom.
Right. No tart taste to the whole case. No takes at first place in the go-kart race.
No breaks. Teach peace to the babies, we're all the same.
At least for the home sake.
Stepped on an undisclosed race.
Get your nose ache.
We're not just rhyming back and forth. I actually land a rhyme stacked on top of his, where I say, like, until at the same moment as he says, done chill.
What's the mission?
Making thunder, shaking blunders in this self-pick undertaking on a fun-filled
done
run
chill.
Until...
It ain't all about the dollar bill. You could be dead broke and be a scholar still.
That's true. What question should I ask you?
And then I left out 1 mil. He says, you can be dead broke and be a scholar still, done chill. Anyway, so I was like, but what if that was a whole style? What if you were like rhyming on top of yourself and it wasn't just internal rhymes, but like these stacks of rhymes were like leapfrog, lily pads, and you were bopping from one to the next. So that's kind of how I wrote it. Mm-hmm. And as concrete poetry, it's beautiful. But once I started tracking it, I was like, this is taking the type of effort that makes it not fun to do or listen to. Mm-hmm. So I quickly scrapped it and then just did it kind of more straight.
Lyrical leapfrog, put you in a deep fog. A sleep cog in the wheel, steal like a cheap dog. Reblog all you want, I'll kick a new style. True route to do now is a banner drawing match, a step in a duty pile. I got some new rhyme thingy to overlap. Clover sap at the root to pick my own luck. Struck by the thought that my label shoulder tackle.
So I don't know if that intentional, crazy, structural, visual thing, you know, the ideas that people get from a song are from what you managed to do, not what you intended initially. And maybe that type of thing doesn't even always matter, although mm-hmm. I'm grateful for the ability to describe it. I mean, what do you think about the song in terms of what it actually is?
I thought it was fascinating because something will end a line and then it'll start immediately with a rhyme. And so eventually you start thinking, well, if that's the pattern, how does he ever move off of this rhyme scheme? Mm-hmm. And that to me was the top level, not necessarily deep, but kind of the first challenge in it that I noticed that was interesting. If you're set up so that you go boom, end line, begin rhyme, how do you move from one rhyme scheme to the next? I thought that was interesting.
That's just instinct. You know, I think, you know, whatever sounds good, mm-hmm. according to my ear.
Right.
But what about what I'm saying? Did you think it was just gibberish?
No, I definitely thought it made sense. One of the other records on there, there's a lot on that record to talk about. The title and every song title except for Undoing Aloneness has the, I don't know if there's a particular name for the three parentheses that, if I have it right, was originally used by the alt-right to signify that someone was Jewish in a way that wouldn't be caught by like Twitter bots. And people reclaimed once it became more known.
You say that like you're not Jewish.
I mean, that's true. That once we figured it out, fair point. So why?
Well, what you were about to say was up until Undoing Aloneness, all those parentheses are in place. Mm-hmm. And then Undoing Aloneness, it breaks through, right? This album could just as easily, I think, be called Connecting ... like what you see on the bottom of your phone. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, it's Antennas, which has six parentheses, which is like twice the people. I mean, there's Mike is on a couple of other songs, so theoretically it could have been like that too. But basically the parentheses go from being sort of echo chambers to being more like the waves that come off giant antennas.
Oh.
And then Undoing Aloneness has nothing around it because now we're connected. So honestly, maybe it's a little bit overcomplicated. I loved the way that Kendrick did all caps and then a period at the end of every song. I loved the way that Bowie recontextualized a black star symbol. And I just wanted to acknowledge that this album might not exist without the internet in its current form. I wanted to turn those parentheses into something that's a little bit, hopefully, more metaphoric and symbolic and broader than just a Jew, non-Jew, Twitter, non-Twitter thing. And use it as an organizing principle for these songs where I'm trying to explodify identity from every possible angle, whether it's the journalistic approach or storytelling or from the gut or all the different ways that we're put into these slots that we accept in order to find community. When we were off mic before, we were talking about how environmentalists will say it's not too late to fix blank, when really it's definitely too late for certain aspects of curative action. What we really need to do is minimize the danger. But they've learned that dire warnings make an impact on absolutely no one. And there's even been like neurobiological research into why we can't handle warnings. As a species, we don't seem to be capable of long-term action, especially when it's presented negatively or as a warning, right? All we know how to do is like run for our lives. So are we going to be crewing up as the ecosystem collapses, or are we going to find a common thing to work towards?
And so that ties into some of the stuff about race that you talk about on the album, including the song actually called Race.
Right. Well, that's Youngman's song.
Youngman is a rapper of Italian descent who, according to Paul, is his brother. Youngman is definitely not Paul Barman using an exaggerated Italian accent. I don't know where you got that idea. Certainly not from us.
Yeah.
But yeah.
You are on that song also, in addition to Youngman, right?
Mm-mm.
No?
No, I gave him a solo on that.
How come black got blue, black, red bone, brown, and high yellow? And yet somehow there's only one type of white fella. We should do shades of white based on crackers. Like, yo, you know my friend John the actor? Who? You met him last night, glasses.
He wanted to be on it a lot more. He wanted it to be like a Cuban Links kind of guest appearances.
Tell me about Youngman.
Have you heard The Redux by Prince Paul?
Yeah, I heard his.
So Youngman has a song on there.
Every time we on a road, it's the same old thing. Dames want to roll around, dudes want to go hang. In South Dakota, the promoter refused to see us sober. He had a bucket of herb hung from a pole slung over each side of his shoulder.
And Youngman works with Milo a lot. Mm-hmm. He's on the Scallops Hotel album and on Who Told You to Think.
Here we go. I regret to inform you of your imminent demise. Men, put your phones down, look your women in the eyes.
understand. Let go your old plans. Children hold hands. Your new role demands that if you got...
And he has his own SoundCloud, Youngman's nephew, because whatever, he made my son set up all his digital stuff. He even got on Instagram recently just to argue with me. Whatever. You know, my attitude is, make your choice. Are you going to be above this digital gobbledygook, or are you going to engage with it? Whatever. I'll talk to him about it. But so he's been in the cut for a long time. He has one rhyme like, I got my own restaurant. Used to think I'm whack. Now I'm the best you got. Now that rhymes are a little bit more few and far between as they used to be, he's kind of having his moment.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really hoping that he can make hay of however Echo Chamber spreads around the world so that he can kind of ride that into his own projects. And Paul and he are working on a bunch of demos.
Okay. And so what does Youngman express that Paul doesn't?
You mean me?
Yeah.
We don't see eye to eye on a lot of stuff. He seems to be kind of stuck thinking he needs to be super provocative, or like, I guess I shouldn't talk about someone who's not here. Point being, he's all comedy. That's really what it is. I'm trying to be all nuanced and interesting. And he knows that the stuff that I'm realizing and talking about perhaps a little bit stridently, a lot of people have known for a long time, and that's why they want party songs.
Okay. And so on race, I guess he, and maybe you can answer for him on this a little bit, talks about this idea of how society, at least in an American context, acknowledges different shades of Black people, but does not acknowledge different shades of white people. What does he think it would give away, or what kind of part of the game would be up?
All right. I can't speak for him, but I can tell you what I think.
Sure.
First of all, that is a brilliant piece of stand hop, that entire verse.
Mm-hmm.
The one drop rule is so preposterous on its surface that it takes immediate preschool indoctrination to ignore.
Yeah. The other thing about that track, he mentions Charleston on it, and Charleston as being some kind of watershed. Right, he says, since Charleston, all bets are off.
Since everyone is like me, I'm not at the side, but the center of it. Good thing my white tenant pays more rent in my tenement. Since Charleston and so on, all bets are off. Tiptoeing around hot button issues, melt some cheddar soft. So scared to be wrong.
What changed?
Wow, a lot of stuff happened after that, too. And obviously a lot of stuff happened before it. And when he says, we gotta talk about this stuff.
Timbuktu wasn't forgotten in a day. We gotta start talking or we're gonna rot in the cave.
I think even that phrase is a little bit fraught, because mm-hmm. talk about this, you know, everything's all chatter now, right? And like anger, and you know, I even saw Michael Rapaport making fun of white women at the Women's March, holding up signs, taking white women to task.
Actor and director Michael Rapaport took a photo from the January 2018 Women's March of activist Patty Delgado holding a sign that reads, "Hey, white girls, you're also part of the problem," and put it on Instagram. His caption read, quote, "White people mad at white people is the whitest white people shit ever." However, Delgado, while light-skinned, is actually Latina. Rapaport DM'd an apology that actually contained the words, "I apologize if you were offended." When Delgado was less than thrilled, Rapaport attacked her on Instagram, calling her crazy, sad, alone, and saying that she, quote, can eat dicks. Delgado responded, "For him to make this joke completely diminishing my efforts to make a criticism of white people like him and hold them accountable is some typical gaslighting fuckboy rhetoric."
And it's like, how are we going to get through this? So the bottom line is, white people have to have a racial reckoning.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because one of the main points of being white in an American context is sort of de facto, no one's asking you to think about race.
Even more than that.
Or you don't have one.
Yeah. So I think it's hard for a hard working person to look in the mirror and say, I didn't get here on merit, but we have to do what's hard.
Well, I'm glad you're bringing up so much of this stuff, and Youngman as well on this record.
I think Youngman does it by accident or something.
Well, on the title track, actually, you, not Youngman,
mm-hmm.
deal with institutional response to police violence, or I guess lack of institutional response. to police violence.
Right.
With the decline to indict.
A veteran in rhetoric can pass a strange law. Decline to indict reminds me I'm white. Euphemism infuses schism in truth and wisdom. Decline to indict, a new euphemism taken to filthy heights.
Come, Michael. Right, that was focus on taken that, from the Baltimore type headlines, and then it kept happening.
In September 2017, the Department of Justice decided not to bring charges against Baltimore police officers for the death of Freddie Gray, who was killed while in police custody in 2015.
What was it about that phrase and sort of what that evoked that got you?
Well, doesn't it imply that the grand jury has issues? To say it extremely lightly, right? So if this genocide is infused in the justice system, what in the world are we going to do? Look, you know more than me. I'm asking you.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had answers. I would be, you know, I would feel a lot better about the world. And you kind of bring things back 150 years or so with What to the Slave is the 4th of July speech that you nod to on Being Poor.
Right.
What to the slave is the 4th of July? What to a brave is the worth of an island? And what to a bird is fireworks in the sky? Iron Pot Cooker, 1975.
Vanguard. What was it about that speech as a piece of oratory that grabbed you enough to bring in, and why mention it on Being Poor specifically?
Well, if I recall, the lyric kind of tries to go further, right? I need to check my notes. I wish I brought my index cards. What do I say? What to a brave is fireworks in the sky, right? So it's not just, so it's, a, okay, so it's a few things. One is, when I was little, I was like, the 4th of July is really weird. And I didn't have the comfort of all the people now who think that the 4th of July is really weird. You know, a lot of these movies with big explosions, those are like real explosions. And they're like blowing up entire mountains, stuff like that, like for movies. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think lately some of it has become CGI. You know, it's bad enough when you're creating a highway that doesn't need to explode a mountain. And it's extra crazy when it's just like the straight to video Demolition Man part three action sequence. Like that's a mountain,
right?
There's an ecosystem there. So how can I say this, Sean? So I guess I've noticed that in my public school education and in my children's, slavery has become more present in the curriculum and native genocide is still absent.
Mm.
So by connecting, by going a little bit further back, like not just talking about what to a slave is the 4th of July, but then like pushing that a little bit further back to
what you've called the Decacost.
We eliminated a flavor to keep it expedient. Estimates approximate 60 million megaloss Decacost. Repeating it.
Barman explained in a 2009 interview with the Seattle Times that the Decacost was his word for the 60 million natives who were killed in the settling of the New World. That is 10 times more than the 6 million Jews who were killed in the Holocaust. We'll have a link to the interview in the show notes.
Oh, nice. Yes, you really listen. The Decacost to the earth, right? So, plus it all rhymes. And I guess now that I think about it, although, like I said, I'm not the best person to analyze my own songs, how poor can I really complain about being, right?
Right.
Like, what chutzpah to use that beat at all?
So, commandments.
Yes.
To dig into the Jewish stuff for a second.
Okay.
First off, it is a rhymeslation, right? In a sense.
Yes, it is. With a lot more editorial input this time.
Similar to Mamatu, though, you now knew no other gods before me. Leave Osiris behind, I'm your highest authority. To act morally, thou shalt not make unto me any graven image. Forget all about your vintage pagan lineage.
One of the fun things about it for me is that the Ten Commandments in the public mind, whether you put stock in it or not, it's thought of almost neutrally as like, here's a set of moral rules.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things the song does so brilliantly at the end is bring it back to its original context of like, this was rules for a tribe.
Tenth commandment, thou shalt covet not. Thy neighbor's wife, if you have a life you love a lot.
And when I say neighbor, I mean neighbor next door. He takes the lives of the wives of neighboring tribes while they're in labor with sabers and knives. Thou shalt also covet not thy neighbor's house, ox, or donkey.
And the rules explicitly did not, as you point out, apply outside the tribe.
Right.
And I thought that was super interesting to bring into a song.
Sure.
Yeah. Why set the Ten Commandments up the way everyone expects and then knock them down at the end with that reveal?
Oh, I think I'm knocking them down all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the case of the Ten Commandments, I wanted to learn about them. That's how writing songs is not just the way I express myself, but also the way I investigate,
mm-hmm.
right? So I don't want to walk around as ignorant as I am. Love thy neighbor sounds good, right?
Yeah.
I guess I didn't realize how much history impacted me until now-ish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's fun to walk around and be like, it's all new with every generation.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't, I guess by really researching the Ten Commandments, you find out how these double standards could exist, or like why the separation of church and state is so important, or how such horrible behavior can come from the church when I only superficially know love thy neighbor. Love thy neighbor sounds pretty good, right?
So but how could it,
but it turns out there's like this whole underlying iceberg under love thy neighbor. The context is, well, it depends on what neighbor means, right?
Yeah.
Am I answering your question at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned the impact of history. I remember it took me far longer than it should have to kind of get an idea of that as well. I remember being in, I think it was Kansas, but right on the Missouri border. And there were all kinds of comments from people who live there about how Missourians are bad drivers and they're dumb. It was friendly jokes that mm-hmm. you would kind of make about people in neighboring state the way, you know, New Yorkers might make jokes about people in New Jersey or whatever. But it pretty clearly came from the Bleeding Kansas times.
Right? Wow.
And just being there and kind of seeing that.
Tell me about Bleeding Kansas times.
It was when there was a fight over whether Kansas is going to be a free state or a slave state. So, you know, people from Missouri wanted to be a slave state. Would come in and like sacked Lawrence and
oh my gosh.
Ran over, you know, came over the border to vote in elections on whether it be slave or free state. And this is when kind of John Brown and his family got their, you know, first came to public notice fighting in some of those wars and things.
We'll have a link to some actual information about Bleeding Kansas from the Kansas Historical Society in the show notes.
So yeah, I think seeing history flattened out over the decades to jokes about how the people in this neighboring state are bad drivers or whatever, but you could trace it back to, you know, very visceral, very bloody time in history. It was pretty eye-opening for me.
So I find that we really need a sort of bedrock of gratitude and values that would come from religion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we or I or like money, society or whatever pushes religion completely away for maybe good and bad reasons, but then we still need those things. And that's why I think a lot of people wish religion was a great thing. When the lack of values and community-minded feeling and this sort of gratitude that would prevent all sorts of bad habits is very painful. Excruciating even. And I wonder how we can have those things.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas?
I mean, I have no idea, man.
I'm looking east, right?
Yeah.
But then east is looking west.
Mm-hmm.
So is it just a grass is greener thing, or like I'm idealizing something? A
tradition with its own long and complicated history
exactly.
And its own interactions with class and race and all the rest of it.
You said it.
Yeah. When you were telling me about the album, you mentioned Age War, and you said it was based on a Martin Luther King quote. And, you know, I looked it up, and sure enough, I'd rather be dead than afraid, mm-hmm. which is a, you know, a quote you quote it, and then you sort of interpret it, say it in different ways a few times over the course of the song.
Uh-huh. They're united against us, we're fools not to unite. Yes, they outweigh us and they tower in height, but I'd rather be dead than cower in fright. We're gonna die soon regardless, let's be free now and be godless. The hereafter is a hustle, a fear factor.
Also highly influenced by the third in the Gidwitz Grimm series, A Grim Conclusion.
Okay, what is that?
I didn't mean to cut you off because Martin Luther King is more important.
Please.
Also, there's been very, very few kids versus adults pieces of culture, and they are needed.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mean to jump in so fast.
No.
I did. That phrase hit me really hard.
I mean, he said lots of stuff, a lot of which is more famous. Why that quote?
So have you read The Radical King, edited by Cornel West?
No, I don't think so.
It is his mission in that book to make his less famous speeches more famous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely mind-blowing. And I had numerous mind blows reading that book. One of them is when he said that, he meant it. I don't remember if he said that during the...
It was
during
the
April 3rd.
Very end of his life, right around the last day of his
life. Did he say that on April 3rd?
I think he may have.
We have one source that has King saying this on April 4th, 1968, the day he was killed.
I think it was also kind of a catchphrase.
Right.
Where he, you know, and I have my moments where I feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my moments where I am too afraid to die. I would be afraid, especially as a dad,
mm-hmm.
to die. And the fact that he said that and meant it is something I have no words for. I would like to get a little bit crackpot while we're talking about April 3rd, 68.
Mm-hmm. Shoot.
I don't understand why the speech he was gonna deliver wasn't in this book.
The sermon King was writing on the day he was assassinated, which he planned to deliver the following Sunday, April 7th, 1968, was called Why America May Go to Hell. Almost nothing is known about it other than the title.
And I know it exists, and I would really, really like to read it. Brother Cornell, if you're listening, did you take any photos of it when it was revealed to you? What was in that speech that he didn't get to give? At the end of that book, Cornell West says that this is the most important book in his corpus. Now, I took Latin in middle school against my will. And I know that corpus means body.
Right.
And when I asked myself, why would the book that you merely edited and did not write be the most important book in your body of work? Mm-hmm. I was like, you think this book resurrected him like Christ? It's just conjecture. I believe that Brother Cornell was attempting to resurrect what he calls the un-Santa Clausified version of MLK with this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that I strongly recommend everyone check it out. And you know what else? All those MLK speeches, all those Angela Davis speeches, all those Malcolm X speeches, all those Fred Hampton's records, what used to be obscure records, are on the streaming services. You wouldn't believe who you can search for in the search field in these streaming services.
Mm.
Oddly, some of the speeches are like disjointed or like on different records and like different quality,
mm-hmm.
like different lengths. Anyway, not only should kids have a right to vote, kids are gonna have to band together to survive eventually.
To bring it back to the song, you're saying specifically against adults.
Right. Yes.
Never underestimate the power of children. Find every adult that you can and then kill them. They're united against us. We're fools not to unite. Yes, they outweigh us and they tower in height. But I'd rather be dead than cower in fright. We're gonna die.
There's really no question that we're killing them. So what are they going to do about it?
Does that make you feel weird to say as a father of two children?
I think the logic is utterly indisputable. I mean, you could create an analog about our current situation, which is 50 to 100 families are gathering so much wealth and resources at a time where the rest of us are also kind of waking up to the situation that we're in, that even though we know that, we won't have enough power to protect ourselves. So we're kind of those kids in a way.
I noticed that on...
Is that too apocalyptic? You just want to move on?
No, I think that makes sense. But what caught my ear on antennas was you quoted Saul Williams.
I did?
Beliefs are the police of the mind is a line he has used. I don't know if he originated it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Beliefs are the police of the mind. Beliefs are the police of the mind. Beliefs are the police of the mind.
Beliefs are the police of the mind. Chiefly designed to relieve us of our fiefdoms of time. Resigned. Said no one ever. Every text from my...
So, well, I guess to start with, where did you get that line from?
I don't remember. Somebody said it to me.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully the continuation of the rhyme is something he hasn't said.
No, he has not.
You go Saul Williams.
Yeah. Well, I guess that shoots my question about you heard someone say that phrase then.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's a moment on that song where you kind of start almost ranting about how things used to be and they used to be better. I think you used the example of they didn't have online dating back when I had to actually ask girls out.
I'm from the flirtatious Cretaceous era, back when we asked girls on dates and faced the terror. But I leave the bitching and moaning to the rich Roman old men. Young cats make dope raps, don't act like there's a glitch in the moment.
I didn't say things used to be better.
Well, you kind of catch yourself.
Well, right.
You head in that direction for a second.
I think talking
then you
to
catch
humans,
yourself.
Human to human, mm-hmm. is better. Mm-hmm. I think knowing who your friends are because you're looking at them in the eyes like we are right now, mm-hmm. is better than not doing that.
Right.
And when it comes time to court somebody, I don't really know because I've never had the misfortune of using one of those. Mm-hmm. But I do think that probably people would be better off like that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say I catch myself going there, but then again, I sort of, before I start extrapolating just generally things used to be better.
Right. Then you say, don't act like things are so bad nowadays and things used
definitely
to be better.
Definitely not. There's so much dope young hip hop right now. And if you are not seeing it where you want to see it, what did you expect? You have to keep digging for it. I don't know why it's so hard to find, but once you do, it seems like there's this universe that never gets any shine by whatever clickbait couture.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there and it's on tour across the world.
Right.
So it's not so underground.
I wanted to ask about a word, mm-hmm. with you.
Mm-hmm.
There's a word you used on a record in 2000. You may see where I'm going with this.
No.
That later showed up on television about 5 years later.
Oh, yeah. My claim to fame.
Yes. So
I didn't invent that word either.
Okay.
I was just the first to say it on record or in print or, whatever you would call publication.
Okay. So to that point, do you remember where you first heard Vijay?
My college buddy's younger sister's University of Oregon crew said Mrs. Vijay in casual conversation. And I was like, what did you say? And I thought it was so funny. At that time, I didn't know I was a writer yet, but I locked it away in my word bank regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And, it came out when I needed it. It's very stimulating.
Look, a shooting star.
It's a fucking satellite.
Lady, one more complaint and I'll shove a rape whistle up the Mrs. Vijay.
What'd you say? Listen, Slim Shady. Tell Dre he better fucking pay me.
And then it just caught fire.
Right. I mean, an interesting thing to me is that when Shonda Rhimes was asked about it, she claimed that she came up with it.
The Vijay is undiscovered country. It is the motherland. You've never traveled there. You don't know its customs and ways.
In a 2015 interview on NPR's Fresh Air, Shonda Rhimes was asked about the use of the word vajayjay on a February 2006 episode of Grey's Anatomy. She said that she had, quote, come up with the term.
I didn't know that.
I saw an article just the other day. She may have been misquoted. She may have meant I pulled it out for use in a television scene, not I made it up on the spot.
Maybe she knew the same people as me.
Maybe she knew the same people in Oregon. But so you're saying even by the time you used it, it was sort of in the ether.
Who knows? My album came out in 2000. I think I heard it in like 97.
Mm-hmm.
So if Shonda's reference is recorded as earlier than 2000, facts are facts.
Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about being associated with the first person to use that word in a definable, we can look back and see it?
Well, to
way.
Have a first citation in the Oxford English Dictionary is probably as close to a Pulitzer as I'm going to get.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to, down talk myself, but I do have poet friends who are like, oh, you can retire. That's a lifelong aspiration right there. It's a thing. It's a thing where it's like, it's in just a few words, you can convey that you're a little bit left field, but put a stamp in Western culture regardless. Like, that's what it means to me more than what it exactly it is.
Mm-hmm.
MCs are trying to invent and flip words constantly.
Right.
Like, Echo Chamber is the first time anyone's ever said fart meat.
Your brain boost is
my main use. With each heartbeat repeated and fart meat excreted, I spark offense against the dark arts heat. Neat. Hindsight's a divine right.
Is that really?
It's probably not going to catch fire the same way. It's not right. as fun to say. It's not as juicy a subject.
Yeah.
But it's another, word invention.
Amazing. So we were talking before the mics were on about radical politics, milieu. I said that I had done stuff with Food Not Bombs for years. Mm-hmm. And you have the two songs on Palleluja, NOW, and I guess both parts of Anarchist Bookstore.
Yeah.
That kind of poke fun at that world, but in a way that sounds to me very loving.
Absolutely.
Are you free?
Green all around, professors and skate punks rock SD Paul's ball of sound, and there's Anarchist Bookstore. That's more than you look for. Core of local folks wait for late lift. There's often a great drift to the shop for the Wednesday night 5 to 8 shift, cause the clerk at work is the prettiest gal in town. She cries during Allentown, a precocious socialist, and she's willing to pal around. She's twice as cool.
What inspired those songs? Was it being at Brown? Was it just like...
I would say NOW was more college, mm-hmm. and Anarchist Bookstore was more Chapel Hill, particularly... Mm-hmm. The Internationalist, which I don't know if it still exists.
And that was a radical bookstore in Chapel Hill.
Sadly, Internationalist Bookstore and Community Center closed in September 2016.
And that's where they had Food Not Bombs every week. Mm-hmm. And that's where sometimes I ate. And thank you very much for your hard work.
You were also a radio host when you were in Durham, XDU.
Mm-hmm.
What did you play?
Well, I had a college show in Providence, too, on WBRU for a short time. On WXDU, they had sort of like a loose playlist, like mm-hmm. you could play whatever you wanted, but there were certain shelves that you had to do, one or two from. I remember I played a lot of the Sadies and Andre Williams album called Red Dirt. I mean, I played, whatever I thought was great or like whatever I could comb through the stacks. It was a free form show. I'm sure I played a lot of hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly. Sean.
Sure. Sure. I wouldn't ask you for playlists. I don't think, you still have your logbooks or whatever. On Palleluja, to continue sort of on that vein.
I just tracked Anarchist Bookstore Part Zero, by the way.
Oh, excellent. I can't wait to hear
Middle School Library. The prequel.
Amazing. On Cock Mobster, both on the studio version and then the live version that ended up on, bonus for, future pressings of the album. You mentioned a lot of women.
I let my hair air dry, thereby getting more hair pie. I want a Fire Blanks and Tyra Banks. Ooh. I like Sean Quinn lasses with horn-rimmed glasses, but Cindy Crawford offered. I would keep a tidy room for Heidi Klum. I'm immersed in Kirstie Alley's Thirsty Valley. I would snore or sleep on...
Did you ever hear from any of them?
I don't think so. That's not my proudest moment.
Why not?
It was... Now I'm of the opinion that you don't talk about people you don't know. And if you do, you say nice things.
Mm-hmm. And these were all, or almost all public figures who you didn't know.
Yeah.
So do you still perform that song?
Never.
Wow. When did you stop doing it?
When frat guys started requesting it.
And then you realized maybe... Something was not a good idea.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That definitely makes sense. You mentioned on the title track, you have, it's about education. Education is obviously a theme that runs through a lot of your work. You mentioned the Black Mountain School in passing.
I know I'll reopen the Black Mountain School and bring back to us the abacus as a counting tool. Y'all know
Black Mountain College was an experimental college in Black Mountain, North Carolina. It opened in 1933 and was organized around John Dewey's progressive ideas. There were no course requirements, grades, or degrees. And the school involved the students in every level of decision-making. Buckminster Fuller, as Paul notes, was a faculty member. Maris Cunningham formed his dance company there, and John Cage staged his first musical happening at the college. It closed in 1957.
Which I only knew about because I had a much older friend who actually ran Food Not Bombs,
mm-hmm.
who had gone there in the 50s, 60s, something like that.
As a student?
Yeah.
What did he or she study?
I don't remember. He only talked about it very briefly and his main memory, he's deceased now. His main memory was that to show you sort of how free it was that they never did bed check. That was his emblematic story of sort of how free thinking they were.
What is bed check?
Where to make sure you're in your bed at night at the dorm or whatever. Someone would come around.
It's not the Marines.
I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing they would do at a prep school. Black Mountain School, what did that represent to you?
Oh, man. Didn't Buckminster Fuller teach there? And like a bunch of Bauhaus professors who fled?
Mm-hmm.
It represents a fantasy of the most cutting edge education in this country, in one of the most beautiful parts of this country, where the concept of interdisciplinary is so infused into what's happening that you never even have to have a little meeting about it. And grades are never mentioned. And it doesn't even matter if you get a degree. If you dip your toe in the pool of that inspiration for a month, you're different forever after. It's the kind of clearly I'm idealizing something that possibly has been so poorly documented that I can keep doing that.
Sure.
Not that I've read all the, you know, coffee table books on the subject, but I guess it's just the place I still want to be.
So what was it like having two kids go through schooling after, I mean, well before you had your kids, you had, you know, song treatises that compared education to jail, or compared school to jail, I should say, not education.
What will we do when we have our own kids? Give them 12-year bids just after the bars come off the cribs? Work within the system? Make them listen to the darkest lecture in the architecture of a prison full of purity scars. Security guards is sure to be hard.
Well,
I guess you have kids still in the middle of that process, right?
Yes. So I feel a tremendous sense of disappointment in myself that I could not provide something better. Probably not being a musician would be a good way to start that. I do deeply believe in public school, and my kids have gotten lucky with some fabulous teachers. I think a lot of them would agree with a lot of the stuff I've been saying. I think that some things have gotten better and some things are exactly the same to my dismay.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the kids I know who are in private school or homeschooled or whatever, there's pros and cons to each of these situations. So I don't completely regret our lives.
Well, that's good, I guess.
I think from the indoctrination point of view, like, you know, the charter school, like the demographically black charter schools are teaching black history in this country in a way that the whiter public schools are not. And that's a shame. We need some of these luminaries on the walls,
mm-hmm.
not just next to the crusty syphilitic beard of Henry Hudson, but instead of.
You had that line years ago about how PE should be taught, you know, universally.
Public Enemy?
Yes.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That person is narrow-minded, not PC. Unless you mean Providence College, PC is as meaningless as the president's apology for slavery. Maybe PE should be on the radio and not just in the African-American Norton anthology.
Obviously.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about something related to rhyme.
Uh-huh.
A device that you use a lot that I think is super interesting. And once I heard you talk about it, I saw examples all over the place.
Oh.
Which is, you will have a multi-syllabic word and then rhyme it with an equal number of one syllable words, I guess, you know, saturated and that sure made it.
Oh, sure, of course.
Just for the hell of it, let's not be selfish. I got our higgledy piggledy. It's a big relief when I take off my fig leaf. She said, Dad, let's get at this. Butter cat and then I'm hot cactus. Sat on her mattress. That sure made it saturated. Sharp thorns and cactus. I put on a hip hop.
So
that's fun.
Is that a device you made up?
No, of course not.
Mm-hmm. Where'd it come from?
What do you mean? That's just rhyming.
Mm-hmm. Who are some other people you noticed using that particular thing?
I don't consider it a particular thing. It's too ingrained in it. I think everyone does it. It's just being playful with language. All the elite lyricists, you're going to see that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how to consider it a device. And then, you know, there's doing it not just with one line. That's, you know, it's seeing if you can continue it. And also on the surface, be certain that it's like a continuous thought of value.
Mm-hmm. That's the other thing about the devices you use a lot, is that no matter how complicated the device, it always has to make sense on a surface level. So if someone's not aware, it's an acrostic.
The tricky
or Morse
stuff
code.
Is extra.
Yeah.
I don't have the world's most mellifluous voice. I need extra reasons for rewinds.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that when you first came out, you said, "I suck at rhythm" at one point.
I can't believe I said that's such a cop out.
Did you feel that way about your rhyming when you were starting out?
I'm totally convinced that I have my own relationship with rhythm that makes perfect sense, possibly has made great strides as proven on the new album, mm-hmm. which, you know, really is new. I mean, this album, there's a big hurdle in between this album and the other ones. Mm-hmm. The same artist name on it is almost funny.
What's a good example of a song on the new album where you feel like your relationship to rhythm is advanced?
Leapfrog.
I'm bad. I second that emotion. It's called a secondary emotion. The elementary notion of confusion, fusion, cut through illusion, delusion. Intrusive thoughts, elusive slots, tandem two things at once. I wish an Irish sheepdog would arrive with cheap garage. People sleep like a log on me, like I'm a tree frog.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone past just rhythm and into tone. Right now, I'm really into the low tone.
I noticed you start the album off that way.
Yeah.
Echo chamber. Let go danger. Stay out of Pygia. They had no idea.
I'm the
nicest since Dionysus. Second well paid, all a sudden self-made. Rugged interdependence, lovers stand at the entrance, arms folded.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
I told myself to talk that way on the mic the entire time while I was walking here. Now I'm finally relaxed enough to do it.
Well, good. I'm glad we get a little bit of the low tone Paul Barman.
Yeah, I think Mike showed me that it was even possible. And then certain things started kind of happening by accident, whether it was late at night or had lost my voice or whatever. And it's just like so much easier to listen to and a lot closer to actually hang out with somebody. And I think actually shines the light stronger on what I'm saying.
Do you have instrumentalists or other rhymers who you think you've taken inspiration from in terms of rhythm and phrasing, if not necessarily rhymes?
Yes.
There must be, obviously.
I mean,
but who?
Qbert is somebody who does stuff with rhythms that just endlessly inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
Dylan's phrasing is pretty top-notch. My favorite guys aren't going to be probably too surprising. Mm-hmm. Like Rakim, Monch. I should say Organized. Black Thought is obviously out of control.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many. I think it's like what feels right and what sounds good to me, but is similar to the rhyme in the sense of it not being predictable. That's just what my ear wants. Mm-hmm. I need novelty constantly. Do you have any rhythmic artists you think I should study? Does anyone stand out that you're like, oh man, this person is doing something innovative with rhythm that I should hear?
I think you covered a lot of people. Other than the people you mentioned, I feel like, you know, I know you listen to Everything's Fine. I feel like what Gene does in terms of both rhythm and tone is when she sort of deigns to bless the world with raps is always next level.
What about non-rap? Because I know Qbert hardly listens to rap.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you want to kind of go back, I know that looking one generation back or whatever is always good. How Ra always cites Coltrane,
mm-hmm.
right? So looking at horn players, looking at piano players, looking at drummers and seeing how they think about stuff. Bass players, I like Richard Bona.
Who's he? For like, what's a good place to start?
He has some duet albums with, it's going to sound super weird and corny, but he has some duet albums with Bobby McFerrin that are—
Why is that weird and corny?
That are bass and voice that are amazing. You can find like live videos of them on YouTube or whatever.
Ornette was my guy more mm-hmm. than Coltrane.
Mm-hmm.
I really love Ornette. And I really like Intermounting Flame a
yes.
lot.
Yeah. Also, speaking of weird rhythms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really love that album.
Mounting Flame is the 1971 debut album by Mahavishnu Orchestra, the fusion band led by guitarist John McLaughlin.
Yeah, that is a fucking great record.
Who else?
Way into that. I mean, for that, to use that as a jumping off point, you know, Friday Night in San Francisco?
Mm-mm.
So that's acoustic guitars. That's McLaughlin, Al Di Meola, and Paco de Lucia live all on acoustic guitars.
That and sounds good.
They're all monsters. I remember seeing Al play at Symphony Hall in Boston and wanting to just set my guitar on fire afterwards.
Are you still teaching?
No.
Are you still playing?
Still play every once in a while. I have some buddies who I've been playing with for a long time who, when they have stuff, will call me, mm-hmm. but not frequently anymore. Yeah.
You should play. You should at least have a guitar in your office.
I am. Maybe I'll get one in there. I was looking back at a bunch of your early press,
Brother.
When you first came out, and it seems weird now, although at the time, I don't think it maybe seemed quite as weird. So much of the early press mentioned Eminem.
Mm.
How did you feel about that contemporaneously? Can you remember? Like, how did you feel about it at the time? Is that something you noticed?
I think I felt as I do now, which is I can't figure out the point of things sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really want people to listen to the music. I don't want people to have heard of me or have heard that people have heard of me or of anybody. I don't want people to measure something by how much attention it gets or from what those sources are. Listen to the album, the whole thing, or listen to a whole song. Listen to Antennas from start to finish. Don't have heard about Quelle, Chris, and Gene Gray's brilliant new album. Listen to it. Spend some time listening. When I was younger, I was like, film is too powerful. It's like a different version of TMI. It asks too much of you. You have to sit there in the dark. It bombards all your senses. And obviously, it's a brilliant medium, but I like reading and I like listening better than movies because I love the fact that you can experience them so differently. And now that I'm trying to learn about energy and sound in particular, I'm learning that sound has the most information on it. So I'm like, oh, it's not a coincidence. I'm obsessed with learning. And sound is the best way to learn, not just because of who I am, but because that's how it is.
Mm-hmm. So then your idea of wanting to, you know, put complicated ideas like the geopolitics of oil into sound makes sense.
Yeah.
Methane CH4 has the smallest molecules. Act now and change is still possible. OPEC holds back, it is viewed for COPEC. So next, Iraq got jacked for its crude. 150 billion barrels. Arab apparel is a kafia, not a towel. After one, two, or three wars, oil...
That song, you know, that song was a warning. You know, you can't make warnings. You can't make warnings. Maybe I still am.
You don't think that song was successful?
Well, it successfully refined oil information, but it didn't successfully... make jokes that would open up a membrane feasibly of someone who disagreed with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's another reason I called it echo chamber. It's like, what do I do with the fact that I am probably definitely preaching to the converted? And entertainment is just entertainment, you know? I think, you know, there's an aspect of giving back to the experience of people who feel like certain words are not heard enough, or certain thoughts people feel like they're alone with. And growing up discovering the musicians like the Dead Kennedys or De La, where I'm like, wow, there really is a big world out there with people on my wavelength in certain ways, right? So I think I'm just continuing that in some way. I don't know if it's as necessary now. I think it probably is. I don't know. Did you feel that way listening to it at all?
Yeah. I like the idea of the title being sort of a nod to your expectations about the audience or your hopes that it could break through an echo chamber or kind of interrogating how is this being taken in by the people who are listening to
it.
And
how can I be more than me also?
What do you mean?
Well, if I understand that I'm limited because I'm a person, how do I become less limited?
Right.
And not just in easy ways like I'm an owl now. You know,
check on our ride in case anyone was hungry for our gourd, hunky dory. As the girl from the Nord country drunkly poured from the berry broth cauldron, Harry Moth Owl lounged with the owlkin all around him. They played hopscotch instead of a rock. They threw
like, how can I really get bigger?
The 99.99999%. I think I got five nines, right? At the end, I got it there.
That was epic.
You have the section at the end where you play with crowd shout outs at rap shows.
Yeah.
Say ow, ow, ow. Ladies, if you understand a better world's possible and wonder if man is the number one obstacle, say ho,
ho.
Say ho, ho,
ho.
Animals, if you love global warming and pee on the ground until you see ovals forming, say moo.
What was the thinking behind that? I don't think you were exactly poking fun at like everybody say ho, all the ladies scream or whatever. Or maybe you
were. I wasn't poking fun. It was more like my version. Mm-hmm. And it also goes back to one of your earlier questions where it's like, how can you take one thing and push it, right? Mm-hmm. So first of all, I remember Doom telling me once that there were certain elements in Lottie Dottie that only happened once, but people still take them as the chorus. So I like the fact that there's one section that does that. And even though it repeats internally, it doesn't repeat again as a true second chorus, right? So honestly, that one, I was just catching a vibe and I knew I needed to switch it up from the scheme that was coming right before it. I also wanted to talk to the people in the crowd, quote unquote, who aren't normally talked to, whether it's kids or bugs or animals, you know. And it then
or
it ends up connecting
non-sentient objects like drugs.
Drugs, if you'll get me high just this one time and won't have me out committing gun crime, say something,
something,
say something, something.
Well, people have strong relationships with them, though.
Yeah.
Be they people or not. It also connects to other parts of the album. Like when I say something about if you reject fake apologies and know that it takes policy to save wrecked ecology.
Children, if you reject fake apologies and know it takes policy to save wrecked ecology, say yeah. Now snore.
You're pushing my memory to remember all this stuff right now at this second. But that line is very important to me because the fake apologies, you know, I always wanted to do a whole song about this. Have you ever heard this, Sean?
I'm so sorry. My generation messed it up for you. It's up to you now.
Every day. Yeah.
So I have an insight for that, which is that that is actually modeling the process of passing the buck. It is not a sincere apology, and it teaches you to say the same bullshit to the next generation. Mm-hmm. That's all that it is.
So by the time this episode comes out, the album will be out in the world.
It will?
Yeah. So what else is going on? What's going on with Paul Barman? He leans back in the chair.
Well, this is a big one. I'm working on some videos for the album, even though it's out, you know, and we're going to start showing what the vinyl and the other physicals are looking like. I have one show set up at Low End Theory right now in LA.
In LA, right.
On July 25th. I'm going to prepare for that.
No touring and no more.
I'm already recording a bunch of stuff with more stuff with Kenny Siegel and Memory Man. I have a lot of other lyrics in the chamber.
in terms of like big time touring, I really don't know. I think it's going to start with some spot dates. Mm-hmm. I really need to do one in New York. It's not hooked up yet.
Yeah. Can we expect to see a full show from Funky Dumpty?
Funky Dumpty swung from a rope. Funky Dumpty fell down and broke. All the queen's monkeys and all the queen's cows fixed Funky Dumpty and then they all bounced. Oh, oh, bouncing.
No, although I am working on some kid stuff right now.
You are.
I just started.
Okay, so what was that?
Yeah, that was just a fabulous one-off thing for a Philly kid station, Sprout.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah, did you see the Sun Salutation one? That was the best one.
No, I don't think I saw
I'll send it
one.
To you.
Yeah, please do.
What would you like to see from me, Sean?
Wow. I mean, I think the album is a lot to digest.
Yeah.
You know, I think that should be plenty. I think it was great to see you work with a bunch of different beat makers on this, including Questlove,
mm-hmm.
right? Who produced a bunch of the tracks.
About a third of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Thank you, Quest.
Yeah. He kind of gave you two beats that you thought fell in two categories, right? One that it was perfect for you and one where you kind of have to prove yourself a little bit.
Well, you know, I would sooner pretend that they were all completely organic. But yeah, the truth is some were totally made with me in mind and some were like, see how these work out.
Are you willing to say which ones ended up as which songs?
Sure. Art of War and Meat and Bone were for me.
Mm-hmm. Next best, destroy their alliances. Third, attack an army fort. Fourth, besiege a city as a last resort. The way's the will to slay without kills. Kids play chess or feel great stress. File him in a class of his own, order words to impress. Facts into his family's memories. Capable of anything, the origin is as specs. Yes, life is cheaper than talk.
I could be wrong, actually. I should ask him. I think the other ones were more, I don't want to say unexpected, but more of something that took me to another place.
Mm-hmm. You had an interesting breakthrough on how to write to them.
Yes. You must have heard my other podcast.
I may have.
Yeah. That was a breakthrough for this whole project. Once I realized I was going to kind of go with the arrangements of some of the music the way it was,
mm-hmm.
That really gave me a structure to finish it
mm-hmm.
and know how it was going to be. Although, you know, there's some exceptions.
Sure.
Like we did add a bunch of stuff here. That was more like a spark to start it. We did, you know, rearrange some things and add instrumentation and things like that.
And, you know, finally, you have a unauthorized biography of Rakim inspired songs for Weird Al. And you have a something similar in that vein for KRS-One.
Oh yeah, did you hear that?
I did.
Ephemeral, physical, observant, a criminal, minded his own biz, homeless, invisible. LP in his head already, McCool and Debbie said you recorded on his ass. Be part of parties like the Red Sea, though Dredd said his CREs mistranslated. Get me, Franklin Mann's out of bed free with a rare high.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
I thought that was great. And I thought it was a little different too. It was a kind of more almost impressionistic approach than the Weird Al one.
What do you mean by impressionistic?
That it wasn't quite as like, here's what happened, here's a thing, and sort of forcing it into rhyme. It was a little like...
Yeah, well...
A little more poetic, I think, in...
Yes.
Yeah.
That's where the rhymeslations can get a little flat, is when you stick to the, and then this happened, and this happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also, you know, it's in keeping with the theme. If Karis is going to talk about metaphysics, then you need to get a little bit metaphysical.
That makes sense. Makes sense. So who's
also
next?
There was a lot more facts, a lot more. I had a lot more source material for KRS. There's just more written about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, having already done that first one, I wanted to do a biography kind of from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
Am I interested in more biographies?
Yeah.
Are you asking?
Yeah.
DJ Yoda told me to do a Tim Westwood once. And
what can you find out about him? He seems like such a fascinating, bizarre character.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a draft somewhere. I don't know if that's my thing anymore. Do you have any requests?
We can talk about it off mic. I don't know. I have to think about it for a second. But nothing burning in you to finish and record.
For the biographies?
Yeah.
Nah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more interested in things bigger than people now.
Okay. So a biography of a continent or something.
Something like that.
Pangea. What else do you want people to know about you, about Echo Chamber? Anything I might have missed?
Wow. I think you
you did an amazing job. I think that if you listen to it, as I said, that's all I can really ask.
Awesome. Sounds like a great place to end. Paul, thank you.
Thanks so much, Sean.
All right.
As you heard in the interview, I've been listening to MC Paul Barman for a very long time and have been trying to get him on the show intermittently almost since the beginning. So I'm extremely glad I got to sit down with him and talk about how he does such unique things with words. Even more importantly, I hope you got a good sense of what makes Paul tick, his interests, his thought processes, and just how open, searching, and curious he still is. And please check out Echo Chamber. It's one of my favorite projects of the year. Join us in 2 weeks when we have Quest the Mad Lad. Quest put out a brilliant debut album, appropriately called This Is My First Album, in 1996. It was imaginative, innovative, and brilliantly funny. We'll talk about that, and also about what happened afterwards. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. Make sure you check out our archives while you're there. If you like this episode, you should listen to episodes 98 and 99, our two-part sit-down with Prince Paul. By the way, if you use Apple Podcasts to listen, go now and give us a rating and a review. It's by far the easiest way to help us out, which is why every podcast you listen to wants you to do it. Seriously, go now and do it. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you each episode takes at least 20 hours of work, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us a buck a month, maybe I could afford the Blu-ray box set of Kieslowski's Three Colors movies. And again, go buy a shirt, a mug, or whatever you want at merch.thecyphershow.com. You can find us at The Cipher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Follow us and let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cipher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
To have a first citation in the Oxford English Dictionary is probably as close to a Pulitzer as I'm going to get.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
That's not my proudest moment.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Lyrics. I'm into lyrics.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Sort of.
Audio editing by Rob Van Vranken.
Turns me on.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Ali Zaidi.
My man Rob asked me to do that.
Extra special thanks to Michelle McDevitt of Audible Treats.
That was epic.
We'll see you next time around on The Cipher.
Made it easy-ish.